Welcome back, everyone. It's great to be here. And we will be picking up where we left off. In our last class, we spoke about really a broad, important introduction to the book of Shir HaShirim. And we addressed the question of why is it in Tanakh? What are the reasons why we would question why it would be in Tanakh, and why is it there? And among the ideas I suggested, and this isn't really a summary, but I just wanted to add another point as we move into the next one, that I did mention that the concept of comparing human love and divine love is a metaphor that runs throughout a lot of very significant texts in the Torah and in Tanakh, both when we speak about committing we speak about worshiping other gods through the language of adultery and other really, really explicit comparisons between them. So Chazal's decision, I would say, to include Shir HaShirim once it's understood as a metaphor, actually fits with a lot of texts that we have in Tanakh. But I also wanted to say, and so I didn't say last time, is that I think that Tanakh would be, if Tanakh is a composite work of many works within it that are meant to reflect the life that we live, and that are meant to reflect the life we live in how we connect to God and sometimes what prevents us from connecting with God. I think that it would be really, really amiss if there wasn't a work about love in all of Tanakh. And I can only say that now that it's already in there. But I think that just like we have Kohelet, which is basically, the biblical manual to depression, and we have some really important topics that make their way into Tanakh, and we have Sefer Iyov, which is a big joker. That's a Hebrew phrase, really, but it's a wild card. That's the phrase in English. It's a wild card book that really takes the biggest theological issues that humans face in the world and says, yeah, we don't really get the world, and God is telling us we can never really understand him. And so Tanakh does not shy away from really from all the important topics in our life. And I think that if we didn't have a work in Tanakh that reflected our love relationships, then I think we would wonder, where is it? And when you read, for example, the poem of Eshet Chayil in Sefer Mishlei, right? It's taken from the end of Sefer Mishlei. It's very, very notable that the entire Eshet Chayil has no reference to anything about beauty per se, physical and love. There's a lot about respect and hard work, and that's a wonderful reflection for women. And I am happy we sing it every Friday night. But there is nothing in Eshet Chayil that has to do with the loving relationship between the woman and her husband. And so I think Shir HaShirim, while understanding it also as a metaphor, I think that it comes and fills in an important gap that would be there if it wasn't there in Tanakh. Okay, without further ado, we're going to jump right in to the poems themselves. We saw the beginning of Shir HaShirim. We saw the first poem itself, where there was a very clear little bit of a power difference between the woman and the man she loved, who she's calling a king, but we're in most of our circumstances going to assume that it's not really a king, but it's her very fantastical description of this man that she has fond feelings for, if not at times a slight obsession. And we saw that also she was looking for something very, very close, although she was fantasizing, and that she didn't actually know him, and they don't really have any real interaction with each other at that point. And so today what we're going to see are a number of small poems that where they actually have interactions with each other. And we'll see what the relationship is like between the Dod and the Ra'aya. The Dod again is the male character and the Ra'aya is the female character. And we'll start from there. So we're continuing in Perek Aleph in the first chapter. Sorry, hold on one second. Just have to organize something on my screen. Okay. שחורה אני ונאווה, בנות ירושלים, כאולי קדר, קריות שלמה. Okay, here she says, now I also want to remind us that whatever division one offers in the book of Shir HaShirim, there are tremendous exegetical ramifications for that. This poem can be brought on its own, okay, and there's all different poetic reasons for why, which I'm going to go into a little bit less in these classes, just because I think that they're just a little bit heavy. But one could also read this as a continuation of the first part that we read last week, where we read about where we read about her description of the nishikot, of the kisses and the embraces of the man that she loves. And whatever choice you make, there are often significant ramifications for that. What can you see as parallel? As we said, do you see these poems as continuous? Do you see them as separate? You know, it's an anthology of separate little poems. And we'll talk about those questions here and there when they're really significant, because sometimes the message is drastically altered if you add another three psukim to the poem. So it's actually a very important question. And as usual in Tanakh, we don't have that much of a sense of how we're supposed to break it up. It's unlike a narrative where there at least the Mesorah has the text broken up into big parts. Like in many places, division of chapters in Shir Shirim is not particularly informative. It's always important for us to remember that the division of chapters in Tanakh was not done by Jewish hands. It was done by a much, much, much later Christian priest and Stephen Langton. And they should be looked at as suggestions and really nothing more. Very often they're very, very spot on suggestions, but they're nothing more than that. They're certainly nothing from Sinai based on chapter divisions. So they don't really help us so much in Shir Shirim. Okay. So she says, I am black, but I am beautiful. Now, this is could be a modern slogan for some of the movements going on around the world today. But she says, I am dark, but I'm beautiful. And she's addressing Benot Yerushalayim, who will speak about who they are in a moment. I am dark, she's saying, like the tents of Kedar and like the curtains of Shlomo, i.e. from the Mikdash. It's always important to remember, and you see how I divided up the psukim, that these are poetic psukim, and therefore the phrases that the pasuk can be divided into are very important. And when you talk about biblical parallelism, very often you have the first half of the pasuk repeated in the second half. Sometimes a part in the first half connects to the part in the second half here, and we'll see all different versions of that. We'll talk a little bit more about parallelism next week. And so she says, I'm dark, but I'm still beautiful. Now, of course, if you were dark, it meant you were outside working in the sun. And that meant that you were of a lower status. And so being dark skinned, while today is a great, you know, it's looked at as very attractive, that back then it clearly wasn't. And we'll talk a lot about that as we read through all these different love descriptions of the different standards of beauty that shift over time and some things that are pretty timeless. And she says, Al tir'uni she'ani shechorchoret. She says, do not look down upon me because I am dark. Shish is a fatni hashamesh, and here she explains directly that I have been tanned by the sun. Bnei imi nicharuvi samuni notera et karamim karmi sheli lo natarti. She says, why am I so dark skinned? Because my brothers, bnei imi means full brothers in Tanakh, okay? They're the brothers I have the same mother with, because obviously they all have the same father. The question was if they were all from the same mother as well. That my brothers, the ones who are supposed to be the most protective, okay? Like Shimon and Levi are for Dinah because they're full siblings. Those brothers of mine who are supposed to be my biggest protectors, they're the ones who put me out to watch and work in the vineyard. But my vineyard, I was not able to protect or to develop. Now, we have a number of very significant phrases that we're introduced to in this poem, which is why I really wanted to start with it. We have Benot Yerushalayim, who we'll talk about in the next slide for a moment. But we also have this idea that there are a number of populations that are working against her, or who the Re'aya sees herself in antagonism with them. Benot Yerushalayim and her brothers. Her brothers will come up again in the future, but they're threatening figures in the background. They are not men that she trusts throughout these poems in Shir HaShirim. And so we get the sense that she's very alone. She doesn't have that sense of protection. And the phrase, the kerem, the vineyard, is a very central theme in Shir HaShirim. Now, like it's often used, it's here both literal and metaphoric. She says that I've literally been working hard in the vineyards. We assume, by the way, from a number of references, she lives in the area of Yehuda, which would also make sense, by the way, if Shlomo's the author, that it's speaking about the area of Yehuda where he's living, the, you know, south of Jerusalem, i.e. from where I'm talking to you right now. But she says, my vineyard, I have not been able to develop. And she often is referred to as a vineyard, and it's supposed to have all of the sensual, sexual connotations that we would imagine, that she is lush and she's developing like grapes. She is gets better with time, which is the image she wants to project of herself. She wants to show that she has a tremendous amount of potential, even if right now there's nothing all that impressive about her. And so the colorful, the green, the lush images of the grapes, which will later be also to describe her body parts, that is all supposed to be right in there in the description, in the metaphor of her to a kerem. So notice here that the word kerem is used to mean literally where she's been working. And also my kerem, my personal vineyard, i.e. my body, is not something that I've been able to work on. I will say, regarding the timeless piece here, is that we have the self-denigration, which is statistically found much more in women. By the age of 8, a sickening proportion of women, sorry, of young girls, will already be able to say specific body parts of which they're not happy with. There's clearly a combination here of nature and nurture. It's a lot of, certainly surrounding cultural expectation, but it comes up so early for young girls that researchers assume that it's not just that. And that really also shows up here, really a sense of lack of confidence, a lack of confidence in what she is. However, there's a spin on it here because she says, I have these traits, right? I'm seemingly lower class. My skin is not the way it should look if I were really worthy of a man like you. But she says, I'm still beautiful. That there's she has a certain confidence. And even though she self-deprecates, she does have a certain confidence. She says that she's beautiful and she's aware of what she perceives of as her faults, but she says, it's really not my fault. So unlike a lot of modern trends we see with young women, and not just young women, she actually really sees herself as worthy, which is a breath of fresh air, actually. Okay. Just going to look at the chat before I move on. Yes. Yes, it could be I am black and beautiful. And now I am black, but I'm beautiful. But the but is definitely here, even if you don't explain the V here as being a con the vav as being a contrast. Okay, who are the Benot Yerushalayim? The Benot Yerushalayim are going to come up. The women of Jerusalem will come up many times throughout Shir HaShirim. In our classes, we're going to see sort of excerpts from Shir HaShirim. We won't hit upon all the psukim inside, but I wanted just to show you them all here. I'm not going to read through every single one, but they're all here, right here on the slide. Whoever want to look through them after, b'simcha. And what's important to note is that the Benot Yerushalayim have two main functions. They act, if I can take a parallel from other literature, they act like the chorus in Greek tragedies. They are the permanent audience for the Re'aya. She always imagines herself speaking to the Benot Yerushalayim. So they're her chorus. They're right. If I think of a different example from *Midsummer Night's Dream*, they're the not they weren't called fairies, that's like Peter Pan, but they, there was some mythical creature there, all those women who will be spoken to. So they're her perpetual audience. They're the proverbial audience. However, they also have a real function in Shir HaShirim. Their real function is also that they are a threat to her. They are her competitors, the other women who are interested in this guy. And so she often will say, for example, I'll just read another pasuk, okay, the next pasuk in the second example, and next week we'll see a beautiful song that I love to this verse. Nishbati etchen benot Yerushalayim. I am swearing to you, or I'm taking an oath, the women of Jerusalem. And she swears on the gazelles and the animals of the wild. Im ta'iru, im ta'oreru et ahava, at that she warns them, lest you not ruin, lest you not spoil this love until it has fully blossomed. Meaning, don't get involved, don't try and get him. We're getting things underway, but it's taking time. Okay, and so they both are her audience, but they're also her competition. And they're a very, very significant audience in the book. And they give us a frame also. They give us a frame for these poems. And they create also one of the number of themes that connect the poems together, even if they're not all part of one continuous plot line, that they're one of the themes like the kerem, like the vineyard, also the Benot Yerushalayim, that connect the poems to one another. taking a break to look at the questions. Okay, that's a great question about the masculine and feminine. Why would she say "Benot Yerushalayim etchem," which is masculine? There's in poetry and also in Tanakh, by the way, the rules are not so black and white, and they're not really kept in the same way we keep them today in modern Hebrew. So we have to not get too worked up about that. It's a great question. Kol hakavod for pointing it out, but it doesn't have particular significance here. She's definitely speaking to a female audience. Okay. I want us to see a midrash. Okay, every once in a while, we're going to bring in a midrash. As I said, that is the frame, that is the theological frame that Chazal envisioned by keeping Shir Shirim in the canon, in Tanakh as we know it. And so I'm going to share here and there midrashim that I find particularly meaningful. There are so many. What I brought you here is from Shir HaShirim Rabbah. For those, you know, who have been learning and are familiar, you have Shmot Rabbah, you have Breshit Rabbah, and they're all written in different times, and they're all very different kinds of collections of Midrashim. But Shir HaShirim Rabbah is, as you see, I brought to you, there's a very wide suggested dating for when it was composed. Shir HaShirim Rabbah is unique in that it doesn't bring Midrashim that are quoted in the Gemara, which is why it's assumed that it's usually a little bit later. Different collections, again, those who study Midrash, it's really a whole field unto itself. But here we have a Midrash about the phrase Shchora ani v'na'ava, okay? I am dark, or in this case, the Midrash, it means I have been tainted and I am beautiful, or but I am beautiful. Either one, I think really works. I'll read through the midrash and we'll explain. Shchora ani bayam sheneemar veimaru al yam biyam suf. V'naava ani bayam sheneemar ze eli vanzehu. Okay, here we have basically each. I'm going to mute. Sorry, whoever I see is not muted. That each phrase of the midrash takes a situation. In the first one is the Yamsuf, the second one is Mara, the third one is Refidim, the fourth is Chorev, i.e. Har Sinai, and the last one are the spies, the story of the spies. So it takes five different scenarios, and in each scenario highlights for us something about that scenario which is complementary for about Bnei Yisrael, and something that is less complementary. Of course, remember that it's using the example of Am Yisrael, because in this poem it's the woman who says Shchora ani v'na'ava, and therefore, as we said, in most of our literature except Kabbalistic literature, the Re'aya is Am Yisrael. The female character of Am Yisrael. So it says, well, when we were at Kriyat Yam Suf, when we were at the splitting of the sea, we had, you know, that we basically, here brings a proof text from Tehillim, that we got bitter or angered as we were going to cross over. But then we also had a beautiful moment where we cry out and we declare that God is our adornment, is essentially our savior. I'll show another two examples. I'll skip down to Chorev, okay, to Har Sinai. Shchora ani b'chorev, sheneemar yasu eged b'chorev. Okay, and here again, it's using Tehillim as a proof text because it needs the word Chorev, and the word Chorev doesn't appear in the Torah. And it says that, you know, I was tainted. We tainted ourselves when we made the golden calf at Chorev, which is what it says in Tehillim, which is another name for Har Sinai. But I'm also beautiful. Because in that place, we also agreed, right? We agreed to listen to all the Torah. And I'll read the last example. And that, of course, we tainted ourselves when we spoke Lashon Hara about Eretz Yisrael. But I'm also beautiful. And he says, but of course, the shining moment of there was Yoshua and Kalev, who were the two spies who didn't take part in the Lashon Hara. And so this Midrash, again, speaking as Am Yisrael, being impersonated by the Re'aya, really highlights this idea that in our relationship with God, within the same context, the same event, we have parts of it that reflect a tainted part of ourself, and parts of it that reflect our beauty. And of course, the Midrash is expressing a beautiful idea, which is that we are complex. We're complex humans, and we are complex. We are a complex nation, and we have our highlights and our lowlights, and they can even be in the same place at the same hour, in the same event. And that's true then, and it's certainly true now. And that's the point that the Midrash really wants to highlight, using Shchora and even Ahava as its jumping point. Okay, that I am both tainted, but I'm also beautiful, and that's true of all of us in life. Okay, I'm actually going to skip this video for now. If I happen to have time at the end, we'll go back to it. But I want to make sure we get to some other things. Whoops. Okay. Moving on to our next poem. Second. Screen just did something funny. Okay. This is a continuation. Hagida li she'ahava nafshi. Oh, by the way. I don't know if I did this last time also. I have different fonts and different colors for when the man or the woman is speaking. It's very important to understand these poems to know who's the speaker. So I've already highlighted for you so that we can all follow together. The purple is the woman, and the blue is the man. And this is really the first time that the man is going to be speaking, which is why it's the first time it's actually you're seeing the colors. So I didn't forget to tell you that. And so now we have our first conversation between them. And this is a really important piece. Now, again, first conversation, I don't know, right? It's an anthology, but we're going to call it our first conversation. First conversations between characters in Tanakh in general are super significant. A topic I'm sure many of you have heard about in different contexts is all the how to meet your biblical wife at the well scene. The Chazal point out, Robert Alter famously spoke about it, and many have spoken about after him. And that really speaks about how each of the patriarchs meet their wives. The circumstance there forebodes and foretells many, many aspects of their relationship with each other. But in general, initial interactions between characters in a narrative tell us a lot about what will happen afterward. It's very purposeful. And so too here. This first poem where they interact with each other will tell us leaps and bounds about the relationship between them. Hagida li she'ahava nafshi, echa tireh, echa tarbitz b'tzaharayim, salama ehyeh ke'otiyah al edrecha. And she says, tell me the love of my soul. Okay, she's already related to him. Where do you graze, right? Where do you pasture with your flocks in the afternoon? And the last phrase, the third purple line, is a phrase that is largely difficult to understand, and there's at most different suggestions. But essentially, what she's trying to say is, I want to know where you are so that I don't stray or find myself among other men, and I don't find myself among the adarim on the flocks of your friends. And so she says to him, I want to go on a date, right? I want to meet you. I want to actually take all of these ideas I have in my mind of how this relationship is going to go, and I would like to see you in person. Now, they clearly aren't in any deep relationship yet because she assumes he's going to be among others, and it doesn't seem to be a totally personal situation. And he responds, Im lo tedi lach hayafa benashim, right? If you don't already know, oh beautiful woman, tzi lach biikvetzon uri'it yediotaych al mishkenot haruim. He says, well, if you don't know where I'm going to be, then go out with your flock and graze and pasture with them among the other shepherds, i.e., go and find me. Okay, he doesn't give her an answer. He doesn't say, I'll meet you under the cypress tree, three rows past the ravine. Okay, he doesn't give her any GPS approved description. He says, you can come and find me. Okay, what we would call playing hard to get. And the phrase, this interaction, playing hard to get, is significant because it will take the man quite some time to come around to the idea of having a relationship with this woman. We will see that she will be quite ahead of him for the first significant portion of the book, and it will take him time. Now, there are all different kinds of relationships out there. There are relationships we like in all relationships. We're not usually all on the same page at the same time. Certainly, when romantic relationships start developing, there's usually one who is slightly ahead of the other. And that is certainly the case here. And so she invites him to go out and meet, and he says, you know, come and find me. You'll have to come and get me. And so that is their first meeting. And she puts herself out there, and he says, you can come and find me wherever you'd like. Okay. I'm going to come back to this poem afterwards. I want to take a little commercial break, and I want us to listen to a song. We have two songs for today, Be'ezrat Hashem, that we'll get to both of them. This song is initially a piyut, liturgical poem. It's much longer than this. This is just a part of it. I've bolded the words that are in the song that are taken directly from Shir HaShirim, but there's much more there than just the words from Shir HaShirim. It's a piyut that was written by Harav David Chassin, one of the biggest paitanim from Morocco, living in the 18th century, so a little bit into the 19th. You can Google him. There's a lot of piyutim of his online. There's a number of wonderful piyut websites in Israel, but I brought you a version done of the piyut by a modern Israeli singer. So we'll all listen to some of it together, and encourage you to follow along with the words on the left side. Again, it's at face value speaking about a beautiful woman, but when these words are spoken by the Paitan who's written them, the assumption is that he's using the words to be a description of a love relationship with God. That's very much at the base of religious liturgical poems, but of course the garb of the piyut is the love language that we have from Shir HaShirim. Okay, just going to skip a little bit at the beginning. It's here. Okay. I'll just there are a whole bunch if you look on YouTube, Yechidat Raya, which of course means my one and only beloved, right? Yechidah, like Yechid. There's a number of really beautiful versions of the song, and there's I'll say I'm also happy if anyone wants to write me. I've debated if about bringing women. I don't know what the policy is. I probably should ask Rabbi Gelman. But there's a anyone who wants to see it. There's a really sweet version of this by one of the women, a young girl who won. She wasn't the first. I think she was one of the top three on one of those really seasons of The Voice. Anyway, she's a great version as well. So I don't know. I'm not really sure what to do about that topic. So I haven't because there's unfortunately with if there wasn't any version of seeing them, then I'd be happy to bring it. But okay, moving on. We are going to see. Oh, whoops. See another song. Okay. So let's go to a different poem. By the way, I hope you all noticed that in this song, Imlot Teilach, right here, is what was in our poem that we just saw right now. So now we're going to look at their description of each other. Okay, and again, here we're going to really get a sense of the rich world that they're living in by the descriptions that they use, because of course we are just a big combination of all of the worlds and all of the tapestries and flora and fauna and views that we exist in. And so we'll really get to see all of that and how that's brought into their words and descriptions of each other now. Okay, looking at the chat before we, yes, I will send a link to the female version, the Simcha. It's very short. It's just very sweet. It's in her audition. Lesusati berichvei paro, dimiti charayati. Now, if my husband wrote me a love note and compared me to horses, I probably wouldn't have gone that much further on the date. But of course, these are different times, and here he's comparing her to a beautiful horse, which in those times were ex it was a pretty exotic animal, right? They're strong. They have, have a mane of hair, and they're exotic animals. They really were known as being from Egypt, and so here it's clearly meant to be complimentary. We'll see later on. He'll speak about her teeth, looking like a flock of goats, right? Everybody and their world of associations. And so he says, "You are like, right? You can be likened to one of the strong, beautiful, we can assume, horses in Paro, in his chariots. And here also he's using images that were obviously very, very common in those times. He says your face, right, your cheeks are beautiful with or like these jewelry called a tol, which I'll show you in a minute. Imagine a little bit like African beads. I'll show you a picture in one moment. And your neck is also is adorned with beads. And here he's saying again that we will, we will make you these jewelries to adorn yourself with. And here again, we have that going back and forth between him speaking very much about the woman and also using the plural language, which we said might be interpreted as a way of a little bit shying backwards, right? I'm not really speaking for me, but I am speaking for me. But it also is a poetic language. And so it's important not to read too much into that. I just want to show you a picture before I look at the second half. Sorry. Okay. Just at the top picture for a moment, that here we have these, again, imagine these beads. It's not exactly what he's talking about, but we have this idea of having these neck beads and jewelry that's on their head. Something related of the sort. Okay, and here she responds. Now, here again, I want to point at the exegetical point. If you don't think that these two pieces are connected, then you won't look at this as a response. But I'm going with the approach that this is, in fact, one poem, and that this is a response to what he has just said. Now, significantly, he has initiated a conversation and he has shown interest in this woman, and she responds. Okay, that. again, referring to him as a king, which had caused many commentators to think that she really is talking about a king or perhaps Shlomo, as we said before. But I'm going to look at it metaphorically. I think she's referring to this man using, showing that he is, you know, so great and so wonderful that he's like a king, which is a phrase also in modern Hebrew. Nirdina tanricho, okay? And that what she's saying is that essentially I was all dressed up for the king's party and had a exotic scent that was on me. Ben Shadayalin. And she says that my dod, right, my beloved, is like a essentially, let's see if I can get this back a little bit so you can see what I want to point to, is as if she has a necklace here that has a vial of incense, okay, which is something that people would wear. My beloved is like one of these vials of incense that lies between, right, between essentially my breasts, okay, that it's a necklace that sits on your chest. Eshkol hakofer dodili, and again, she compares them to really exotic, expensive spices. Bekarmei En Gedi, okay, like the vineyards of En Gedi. Now we have to unpack this image a little bit to get what she's actually trying to say. Now he spoke about her external look, okay, her face and the jewelry she wears. And like what we would imagine for her, she goes, I'm like seven jumps ahead of him, okay? That she already is speaking about him lying on her chest, okay? She is going ahead of what he has done until now. And we also see that because the phrase, Karmei En Gedi, okay, the vineyards of En Gedi. Now, I don't know when the last time you were in En Gedi. It certainly wasn't in the past year. I put a little picture on the side, but En Gedi is a desert, okay? En Gedi is an oasis within the desert, but it's a desert, okay? They don't grow grapes in En Gedi. And so most assume that the Karamim of En Gedi is her, again, referring to herself as a Karim. And En Gedi, that's why many assume she really lived in the area of Yehuda. They both lived there. It must have been very close to their home. And so that's what she chooses to describe. And so in the second part, she's using the sense of smell. Okay. She's really speaking about incense and speaking about him being very close to her body, which is a different tone of a description and of a praise than he praises her in the beginning. And she responds with desire. It's very clearly, it's just not a conversation that's on the exact same plane. And so again, we see a little bit of, they're not totally connecting with each other yet. There's something there that is still not not balanced between them. Okay. Hinach yafa rayati, hinach yafa inayich yonim. Okay, but here we have an additional poem. One that I think some of us are more familiar with, and we'll see that there'll be a related theme to what we just saw, that you are beautiful, my re'aya. Hinach yafa inayich yonim. And here he goes a little bit deeper. He says, you're beautiful, and your eyes are beautiful like turtle dove, meaning that they're very piercing eyes. And then she responds as well. Hinach yafa, hinach yafe dodi af na'im, af el senu ra'anana. She says that you also are beautiful, my dod, and you are pleasant. Af il senu ra'anana means that our bed essentially is ready, right? Is fresh. Okay. And again, here he is saying something that is a lot less daring than she is, and she herself goes much, much deeper. And we'll see that also in the next phrase. Hold on one second. Okay. Okay, and she says, now speaking about their home, right? They are just starting with each other. But she says that the walls of her home are like the erez, like the cedar, and our furniture are like the cypress tree, okay? Meaning they're strong, they're sturdy, they have a foundation. Some think that the next three psukim are their own poem, but I am here going with the interpretation that they're one poem. And she says, "Ani chavatzeret haSharon, Shoshanat haAmakim." And she says, "I am like the lily of the valley, She compares herself to a flower. And then he says, Kishoshana ben achochim ken ra'ayati ben habanot. And he affirms her description of herself and says that you are, in fact, that you are not just a lily of the valley, but you are a lily among thorns, meaning you stand out. You're not beautiful among a beautiful tapestry. You are the beautiful one. Ken ra'ayati ben habanot, that's how much you stand out among other women. Ketapuach v'atzei hayar, ken dodi ben habanim. And she responds, like usual, and we'll go a step further. She says, you are unusual among the men, right? So we realize here that ra'ayati ben habanot and dodi ben habanim are parallel to each other, that you are like an apple tree in a forest. And here she goes much, much further. She says, in your shade, I desire, what she means say is, again, it's Lashon Mishala. I wish I could be sitting and be sheltered by your shade, and your fruit is sweet to my mouth. Okay. Which is very clearly also a sexual reference. And also it's significant because if you remember in the first poem we saw, she was speaking about having spent too much time in the sun. And so this dod for her will be like shade and shelter, which is exactly what she was missing from her brothers, right? It was exactly what she didn't have. She wasn't safe. And so she speaks about him as keeping her protected. And his description again is really of beauty, and she goes much further into a much more sexual description. I'm going to check out the chats. Yeah, so there's definitely, again, there's very possible ways to interpret this as even more sexually explicit than I'm describing here, as I've received in some of the chats. Yeah, it's all there, that's for sure. I still think that we'll see in comparison to other sections that this is all essentially poems of desire, because we'll see very clearly when they actually are fulfilling their desires, and this doesn't seem to be it. This seems to be sort of throwing out sort of sexual connotations and phrases, but it doesn't seem that they're actually in a place of sexual fulfillment yet. We'll see that in a different class. Here, I showed you already some of the pictures, but I want to show you some of the others that we have here. This is the Nerd. Here we have Shoshanat HaMakim, and here we have Chavatelet HaSharon, which is, again, here is a sea daffodil. There's some debate about these things, but as you'll see, none of this is a rose. The rose is not a correct translation in general for a Shoshanah. Ayal and Svi are two animals that will be mentioned very often in Shir HaShirim. And Ayal and Svi are not the same thing. We have a deer, we have a gazelle. Ask me exactly what the difference is. I would have to Google that one for you. I'm sure some of you know that more than I do. So here's just a number of pictures to keep in mind as these come up. Okay. I want us to see another midrash that I think also offers a very, very beautiful idea. Okay, here we have again that phrase that we just had in our poem. Okay, this is from Shmot Rabba. What has God been compared to? Letapuach. Lomar lecha, ma tapuach ze nir'a la'ayin kelo klum, v'yesh bo tam v'reach, kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu chiko mamtakim v'kulo machmadim. He says that God, here again, taking the example from Shir HaShirim, where the man is the God figure, that the, why is God compared to an apple? Because an apple, sort of from the outside, doesn't look particularly impressive, but it actually has great smell and great taste. Also, like God, here is bringing a quote as well. V'nir'eh le'ovdei kochavim, v'nir'ah, sticha, le'ovdei kochavim, v'lo ratzu lekabel ha'torah, v'ayta ha'torah b'eneihem kedavar she'en bo mamash, v'yesh bo tam v'reach. Okay, and here it's referring to what we may recognize from Har Sinai, that God tried to give the Torah to the other nations, but they looked at it and said, nah, it doesn't look so impressive. But what they didn't realize is that it also has flavor and it has smell, right? God, the Torah, which is the manifestation of God in this midrash, of course, maybe from the outside is just a tapuach, right? The midrash is assuming that the tapuach is some particularly impressive looking, but that there's great surprises inside. Amru Yisrael, anu yodim kocha shel Torah. Lefichach en anu zazim min hakadosh baruch hu v'torato. Shenemar betzilo chimatati v'yashavti uferyo matok lechiki. Okay, and here it says again, it's a different version of the whole God went around to all the nations and they all said no, but then he got to Am Yisrael. And so Am Yisrael says, no, mapitom, that pasuk that says that in his shade I sat and his fruit was sweet to my palate, that is referring to our decision to engage with the tapuach, to engage with God. That we said, okay, well, maybe on the outside, the Torah doesn't look so alluring, but we know that if you look deep inside, that it holds great gifts and great fruits. And so this is one of the ways that the Midrash reads, one of the many Midrashic readings of the Pasuk. There are so many Midrashim that use Shir HaShirim as a proof text speaking about Har Sinai. I didn't bring the Midrash last time, but the Nishakeni Menishikot Pihu is I think the main proof text for the idea that we receive the Torah through the kiss of an angel. And the pasuk that they bring is from that pasuk that we read last week in the beginning of Shir HaShirim. And so this is one of the Midrashic readings here. Now, what we've seen so far in the relationship between the Dor and the Ra'iya, again, I think that we have to be careful about overreading any particular plot line, but I do think that when one reads the book, there is a certain degree of progression that's there. While everything can't fit right into it, there are certain trends in the communication with them that that repeat themselves, and we'll see them coming up in different sections. And so we've seen this idea that they are now in communication with each other, and that she continually goes a step further than him, that she goes a step further in her sexual innuendos. She goes a step further in imagining their home together, whereas he hasn't yet reciprocated that idea. And so there's still sort of this imbalance in the poems that we've seen so far. So far we've gone from the beginning of Shir HaShirim. From here on, we're going to sort of skip around. But their relationship is not necessarily on the exact same plane at this moment. Now, I want to end off today with a song that is, I think, breathtaking. I'm going to take a minute to talk about it. For those who don't know, please, please, please start putting a playlist of Avitar Banai. Certainly for Hebrew speakers, it's... his Hebrew is very beautiful and his lyrics are beautiful. Avitar Banai is from the Banai family. He's also a Chozer B'tshuva. He lives in Yerushalayim. I actually saw him a whole bunch of times last year. But he, in this song, and I want to tell you why I brought it, it's actually from a quote that we didn't learn this week, but I don't think we're going to learn it inside. So this song really can be for any week. And he, in the video, there isn't a video for the song here, but the cover of the album, which is what you see in front of you, is Yafa Kalvana, which is as beautiful like the moon, which is a phrase from Shir HaShirim later on in the Perkim. And the woman on the cover is his wife. And the reason why I think this song is so genius is because he manages to preserve the metaphor that it can both refer to his wife and to God in the song as well. I just want to look at their lyrics for a minute, okay? And then I'll play it for you. Sufot mitochi umichutz motatu et kirot habayit. He says, the storms inside of me and on the outside have shaken the walls of this house. Ve'at mitochi zoremet mefuzeret vechozeret ayifa veshoteket. Okay, but you are inside of me. You flow, but you're also dispersed. You return exhausted and you're quiet. Now, again, on one hand, he could be speaking about his wife, right? About difficulties in a relationship, about the highs and low, the ebbing and flowing of a relationship with a spouse, with a significant other. עוד פעם כשהייתי ילד, היית בתוכי נשברת. פעם שלך, פעם אחרת, על יופייך לזרים מוותר. But here already you sense that he's not talking about his wife. He says that when I was young, you were inside of me, but you were broken. And here is where you get a sense that he's speaking about a relationship with God, meaning he didn't grow up with a relationship with God, but he's saying, I felt God there, but it was a broken relationship. I don't totally know how to explain the next line. I'm going to be honest about that. I'm happy to hear any suggestions. I think that there's a number of ways to interpret it, but something to the effect of, again, the lack of clear connection with this woman, right? With the woman. And the beauty to others was given up, maybe meaning to say that others didn't see your beauty, i.e. the world around me didn't necessarily recognize God. Lo avakesh davar, at lo tzricha lehochiach li klum. I won't ask you anything. You don't have to prove anything to me. Horidi odem sfatayich, take off the lipstick on your lips. Avak drachim rachatzim eraglayich. And here it's a beautiful play of a verse that we will see later on, but they're not the same verses. He says, take off the lipstick on your lips and brush off the dust from your journey. Hayili krova v'zocheret, hayili rak li miuchedet. He says, be close to me, be mine, be my special mine. Hayili achot mekudeshet, hayi yechifa menuchem. It says, be mine, be my my sister, which is also a phrase for a loved one in Shir Shirim, who's mekudeshet, and here we have a direct reference to being married, and be barefoot and comforted, okay? Because we'll see that later on in a different section, the woman says, I've already undressed. I'm too flustered. I can't open the door for you. And so here he says, no, no, be barefoot, but be comfortable. Don't be flustered. Mizot ola yafa kalvana, okay? Now again, because he puts his wife on the cover, it's very clear to us that he means here, there's both. There's aspects of the song that are both about God and also about a relationship with his wife. It's a blur, and I think that he nails the head and really nails it on the head, the blurring that exists between the metaphor and the reality of it. Okay, so here is Avitar Banai. Enjoy.
ואת מתוכי זרמת מפוזרת וחזרת עייפה ושותקת. עוד פעם כשהייתי ילד היית בתוכי נשברת. פעם שלך, פעם אחרת, על יופייך לזרים מוותר. לא צריכה להוכיח מכלום. הורידי עודם שפתייך, אבק דרכים רחצי מרגליך. הייתי קרובה וזוכרת, הייתי רק לי מיוחדת.
Okay, so that's also a great example. I don't know how many of you are very familiar with Israeli culture, but in general, Israeli is like sort of like low. There's like a lot of low-key music. It's a very big generalization. What I mean is that songs or voices that wouldn't seem like a big deal in other areas of the world in Israel are very impactful. And Avichai Banaa, as you see, doesn't have a huge voice. He has a great voice. Heard him in concert a number of times. But I just think that the song has this beautiful buildup to it. It was actually one of the number one songs the year that it came out. It was very, very popular. And so we'll end with this today. I'm happy to stay on and take any questions. I'm gonna send, of course, the PowerPoint, and I'm gonna look at the chat right now. Okay, yeah, I'm so happy to introduce him. I'm gonna introduce you all to some of the best of today in Israel. I mean, I'll just say a word about Israeli music, by the way, that we are seeing a real renaissance of Israeli music that is influenced by sources. I would say some of the biggest Israeli stars right now are religious men, and actually one in particular, a religious woman. There's another woman who's also very, very popular. Again, I would love to hear. I'm going to maybe ask Rabbi Kellum about this, but another woman who, Yuval Dayan, she has become more religious over time. We're in a real renaissance where music has become the emblem of how much people aren't really divided, and it doesn't really matter who's, from, not from. The sense is that the general Israeli public is looking for meaning in their music, and they're very happy for it to make it to them through many different ways. And so you have a lot of from people, and I don't know if some of you also heard of this, but one of the most impactful songs, it was last 2 years ago, was Yishai Ribo wrote a song which used the words of the Avodah of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest that we say in Yom Kippur. I mean, it was like the hottest song of the whole first half of the year. And that was using the words of the Seder Avodah from Yom Kippur. And so we're in a real renaissance where we have a lot of meaningful music, really good music being put out there on all the big stages in Israel. Obviously, this year has been a big bummer on a lot of levels, but I'm gonna introduce you to a number of them. They're so good. It's also so great when I can feel comfortable having my kids listen to some of, like, the main Israeli stars out there, and the music is appropriate. So that's also great. Anyways, I'm gonna stop the share for now. I'm gonna send the PowerPoint right after this, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I see Tova has her hand raised, or maybe a hand clapping. Anyways, feel free to unmute, and I'm happy to answer anything.
Toda rabba. Wonderful.
Simcha.
Yosefa?
Yeah.
Hi. So, I was really struck by in verse 6 in chapter 1 when she says, "Bnei imi nicharubi," and you brought up Shimon and Levi. And I have, again, this is another counter read of the Shimon and Levi story. They seem to be in this story, they seem to be very much in, their excuse for the, the destruction of Shechem is the honor of our sister. But then when you look back at the story, they should be the caretakers of their sister, and they aren't. They're not watching her carefully, and she seems to wander off and get into trouble, and they should be watching out for her. And this B'nai Imi Nicharubi, this seems like they're saying something that I've always, Shlomo is saying something I've always thought, that she recognizes that they should have been taking care of me, and they weren't. And I wouldn't have gotten into so much trouble had, I guess she's looking for love in all the wrong places. And had they been more careful of her and watched out for her, knowing that she's the daughter of Leah, and they are all the children of Leah, and they are therefore second-rate children in the eyes of their father. And so she's giving voice to something that nobody else has voiced in Tanakh. And seem like Shlomo is giving voice to that, and they put me into a bad situation, and then they just made it worse.
Right. Well, I want to say that I mentioned Shimon and Levi, but I didn't mention it in the sense that I think that the poem is referring to them, but I think that this situation can be parallel to it, right? I mean, I don't necessarily think that Shirshim is talking about that, mm-hmm. but it is referring to, I mean, how many places do we have a relationship between brothers and sisters in Tanakh? Not many.
Yeah.
We'll also see later that, by the way, anyone who's living Purim Sameach, I forgot to say that, that later on in Perek Chet, you can already jump ahead and see, but later on in Perek Chet, we get a very clear sense that their perception of her is wrong, meaning they think that she's little and she's not really ready to, you know, be courting anyone. But mm-hmm. she says they don't really realize that I'm developed and that I'm a woman now, and they don't really have a proper sense of her. And you could compare that to Shimon and Levi and Dina.
And very, Dina, very right. Yes, she doesn't want to leave when they come to get her. Like she wants to be her own woman, and she's made her choice, and she's made a choice. But they don't listen to her. You know,
you're assuming that she had a choice to be made there. There's a lot of ways to read that. There's a lot of ways to read the Shechem and Dina story. Right. Was she a victim? Was there something as choice that existed then? That's really a Breishit Lamed Dalet shir. But their status of choice as women in the biblical world was, and by the way, but that is a very important point, because what it shows us, it's another reason why Shir Shirim, I think, is such an important voice in Tanakh. Mm-hmm. It is, I would say, one of the only places where we have a woman who takes initiative in her loving relationships. And not only that, she is the more sexually explicit one for most of it. And that itself, by the way, I think is also a worthy voice to be there in Tanakh. It's by far the freest woman we see in all of the Bible is the woman in Shir Shirim. Again, Rashi's prison, for example, it also fits with that. It's a woman remembering how unshackled she was when she was younger. It's also a really great additional, it fills in the picture of what it could have meant to be like a biblical woman. Do you know what I'm saying? Meaning not every woman is an Eshet Chayil. Not every woman is a victim. Not every woman is raped. Okay. There are also these women. No, meaning think about the women we know, right? So there's all these different models of women, and Shir Shirim, I think, also just fills in another great version of what it meant. You could also be young, in love, and like sexually in touch with yourself, and like that also makes it in Tanakh, and I think that's a very big statement as well. Again, it's not the strict prism through which Chazal looked at it, but I think it shouldn't be ignored.
And also, as I said, I hear echoes of the Ruth Boaz situation from a non-traditional point of view. You know, in what is it like in verse 6, or is that 7? 7. That hard phrase, Shalama Eheyek Otia al Edre. That sounds like, as she's saying it, the woman, but it sounds like when Boaz says to Ruth, oh, you know, stay here, don't go anyplace else, which is it's the opposite, because the man is not saying that to her. He's brushing her off. But the words are the same, but put into the mouths of the other opposite characters. But then in chapter 2, verse 3, when she says "Bitsilo chimarati veyashavti," that is also reminiscent of Ruth saying to Boaz, "I don't want to be under Kanfei Hashem. I want you to take care. I want to be under your, like, in your shade. You, I want you to take care of me." And she is very bold, coming and she's like this. She's like the Raya here. She's quite bold.
Yeah, Ruth is very, very bold. This is true. She's bold at the obedience to her mother-in-law, which is a certain kind of bold. But she is also very, very bold. It's true.
And she is Shlomo's great-great-grandmother. There's something there. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I really appreciate it.
I was thinking that when you said that she's not like most of the other women in the Tanakh, she seems very assertive. And as she's trying to get closer to Hashem, he seems to like playing hard to get a little bit.
Yeah, that's a very important theme in the Midrashic line of interpretation that we'll see. I will say that we'll see if I'll bring in a quote, but there's a book that Rav Soloveitchik wrote about that exact difficult dance. It's his hardest book to understand. It's called Ubikashta Misham in English. If someone knows, please say it out loud or write in the chat. I'm forgetting what the byline is, but Rav Soloveitchik wrote a book about, we're going to see Rav Soloveitchik in a different context than Shir HaShirim, but he also wrote a book about our relationship with God through the prism of the philosophical prism of how he reads Shir HaShirim. And he speaks about that, right? How we want to connect with God and with a realm that is above our human realm, but it's really, really hard. And so we're invited into the club, but then go and find him, right? Again, it's a very simplistic description of the book, which I also haven't read in many years, but I recommend if you're interested, you can check it out. And that's exactly the point, is that a relationship with God is really having a relationship with something, someone who you can't really describe in any human terms, is a hard relationship to substantiate and keep continually going and inspired, which is of course why we have mitzvot. But yeah, that point is a really important one. And it also comes up in a lot of midrashim, and we'll see some of them as well.
I think it's called "And From There You Shall See."
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. From There You Shall See, right, which is the translation of that.
But I think Rav Soloveitchik also brings in the Hasidic idea that Hashem, or the Kabbalistic idea that Hashem is waiting to be discovered, and that Hashem is like wants us to find him. He's almost at our mercy. So that's like a different look at this relation, that yeah. It's not only that we want to find him, Hashem wants to be found. He's waiting for us.
Yeah. I have a book right myself. It's given me a good motivation to read it again.
So it's a little bit different than this side of it. Where Hashem is playing hard to get. On the other hand, Hashem is waiting and yearning for us to uncover him.
Yeah. Well, that is, you know, the Hasidic version of the world, right? Where there's God is everywhere. God is everywhere. It's a matter of us picking up the pieces that were shattered and putting them, bringing them into our own life. That is the Hasidic worldview. It's theological worldview in one sense, right? Of course, it's taken in many different directions, but that is the starting point, which is very different than God is hidden, I have to go find him. It's saying God is hidden, but he's everywhere. So you can pick up the pieces and find him.
Yeah.
It's
complicated.
Thank you.
In Gedi, wasn't the Afar Simon from there?
Afar Simon. It also is something that can grow in the desert. Is that a specific? You're saying
it's from the En Gedi area.
It could be. I don't know. I'd have to check it out. I'm not sure.
Okay,
but it doesn't make sense. They can grow in very dry weather, so that makes sense.
Yeah. So even though the grapes on the vineyard's not in Gedi, but things did grow there because it was an oasis. So
Well, as I said, there's a bit of a blurry there between like general Midbar Yehuda imagery, right? In Yehuda, where I'm living right now, right? The lush areas where there are vineyards outside my window in Gush Etzion. So here you have that kind of lush, fertile ground, but you drive not so far away. This morning I was in Tekoa at a meeting, and it's, you know, the green is, I don't know, 30% of what we have here. And in another month, it'll be totally yellow, and you have desert. And that's the, you know, if you go further down also to the area of Hebron, right? And Drom Har Hebron, which is still Yehuda. So there you have the more desert areas. So so you have a mix in Yehuda of the very, very lush green and also the desert. And of course, En Gedi is the oasis of the desert, but you have it all mixed in Yehuda. So it seems that all those different images sort of come together in these poems that are written by people who live in Yehuda.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Pleasure. Wishing everybody a Purim Sameach. Feel free, I think I've written it before, but feel free to email me. I'm going to write it here. If you want to send me any questions, hold on, I'm putting it in. And I will send the I'll send the PowerPoint right now. Sorry about that. And next week I'll send it before the class. Okay. Okay. Wishing everybody Purim Sameach. Nice to see you.
Purim Sameach. Bye.